More dire news about Ebola.
Can exercise prevent depression in adolescents?
Will stem cell transplantation come to fruition in preserving eyesight for older people?
And using a capsule of frozen fecal material to treat C. diff infection.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 17th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And unfortunately, feeling tremendously under the weather, also traveling. So we're keeping you in our thoughts and prayers that things get better.
Well, thanks. I'm sorry that my voice sounds raspy. It's a viral URI, and as we've talked about, I'm not taking antibiotics. That would be unnecessary and unhelpful.
But it'd sure be nice to be back in bed instead of recording. So I and our listeners, I'm sure, really appreciate your effort. Let's turn to our first, I think, and the top of the headlines kind of a story. Once again, very dire news with regard to Ebola. The WHO has come up with new projections regarding how many cases are likely to be diagnosed very quickly. And we also have a study in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Just to remind our listeners that on March 23rd of this year, the World Health Organization was notified of the outbreak of Ebola virus disease in Africa. And it wasn't until August 8th that the WHO declared the epidemic to be a public health emergency of international concern. So in this study, based upon the first 9 months of the epidemic, they gave forward projections of the disease. Now, when they performed this study in mid-September, there was a total of 4,500 probable and confirmed cases, including 2,300 deaths from Ebola virus. And based upon the timing, the exposure, the data was available, the WHO estimates that if there's no change in the control measures for this epidemic, by the 1st of November this year, there'll be at least 20,000 cases with a case fatality rate of about 70%.
These are dire statistics, of course, because we've been floating around with regard to the probable mortality between 50% and 70%. This is an upward modification, of course, of those particular numbers. And then if we project out into time, by the end of the year, we're looking at literally 10,000 cases, I believe, a week.
Yep. In 2000 to 2001, the biggest epidemic previously reported was just 425 cases. And that's because they were able to control it with rigorous application of interventions we know that minimize the further transmission of this disease. But those interventions have not been successfully applied currently. And as a result, as you mentioned, it's increased substantially in the number of cases and the number of fatalities.
Clearly, then, domestically, we're having a little crisis of our own with regard to concerns about transmission with these two healthcare workers in Texas who became infected caring for a patient. As I understand it right now, the news seems to suggest that there were breaches in protocol with regard to the personal protective equipment.
And in fact, the authors of this particular study make the point that the present epidemic is exceptionally large, not because the virus has changed in any way. It's not more virulent. However, what's happened is the control efforts have been insufficient, both in Africa and obviously with the cases reported here in the U.S. as well.
And finally, I guess the other piece of information I've heard recently is that they're considering that anyone who comes in through Africa into the U.S. with a fever will be detained and PCR used to establish whether or not they have the infection.
Although it's been limited to certain countries in Africa, because people can move across borders pretty easily, I think everybody's in heightened alert.
For right now, if you were going to give a public health message with regard to this infection, let's package that into two different public health messages. One you would give domestically, another one you would say for international concerns. What would you say?
The first I'd say is, at least nationally, is that unless someone has direct exposure to a person with active symptoms, we have what I call a lot of worried well here in the United States. Internationally, what I'd say is it's not wise for anybody to get on a plane that has any type of a febrile illness, that is a high fever or diarrhea. So one doesn't know what they've acquired or what they can transmit.
And let's then hope that we continue to ramp up our efforts. I saw this morning information from Doctors Without Borders describing how they ramped it up, but that they're kind of reaching their limit and they need other folks to step up. The other criticism I've heard is that somehow we got to coordinate all these relief efforts so that everybody's on the same page. No doubt we're going to be talking a lot more about this, so we'll move on to our next study. Since you just brought up diarrhea, I'm going to turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association, a potentially good news story with a lot of yuck factor that's part of it. What about oral capsules to treat that really troublesome and sometimes lethal pathogen, Clostridium difficile.
I'm going to call it C. diff for short. Both recurrent and refractory C. diff has been really a major cause of morbidity and mortality, especially in older individuals and in pediatric patients globally. And it's estimated that up to 30% of patients can develop recurrent C. diff infection after their first episode. And the standard treatment is to give an oral antibiotic. For people that have two or more recurrences, the treatment failure rate can be as high as 60%, particularly due to one virulent strain of the organism. Now, we know that one can do a fecal transplant, and that reconstitutes the normal flora in the gut. That's been very effective. The fecal material has been transplanted either by inserting a tube into the rectal area and infusing it directly into the colon, or by putting a nasogastric tube in, a feeding tube, and installing it that way. That's obviously not very practical, carries some risk with it, and is uncomfortable. So what the author said is, gosh, I wonder if we could take donors who have been pre-screened, package their fecal material into oral capsules that could be swallowed and reconstitute the normal GI tract that way. And that's what they did. Is they identified healthy volunteers as potential donors, harvested the fecal material, put it in oral capsules, and administered it to individuals that had recurrent C. diff infections, 14 patients. They gave them 15 capsules on two consecutive days and followed them for up to 6 months. 70% of individuals treated this way had resolution of their diarrhea. And for those that didn't respond, they gave a second treatment, and they did respond, so the overall response rate was 90%.
Wow, this is such really great news. We've been struggling with this bug for a really long time. Certainly see lots of transmission of it in the hospital environment. And sometimes, as I suggested, it can be quite lethal. So gosh, wouldn't it be great if we could just do this nice little fairly clean, if you will, packaging and just allow this whole process, this population of the gut to take place that way?
Many advantages over the other technique. You have the advantage of collecting the stool and screening the individual then and waiting 4 weeks to make sure that they didn't have any intercurrent infection that one couldn't tell in the initial screening. Obviously, it's easy to administer and it should be much less expensive. So I think there are a lot of reasons why this is a great success story.
A win-win. Since we're talking about success stories, then let's turn to The Lancet. Stem cells, of course, have been this great white hope, if you will, with regard to the treatment of many different diseases and conditions. Now, it turns out that actually they may help in people with macular degeneration, another form of eye disease.
As you mentioned, Elizabeth, we've had the stem cells available since about 1981. So we've had them around for about 3 decades, and we've not really done a very good job of using their potential. For people that develop macular degeneration, that is the photoreceptors in the back of the eye degenerate, it's one of the leading causes of blindness in the United States and around the world. This particular area is immunoprivileged, and there's concern that when you put in stem cells, they may have unregulated growth. So in this particular study, in people that had macular degeneration, 18 individuals that had their macular degeneration or macular dystrophy, they received injections, different doses of the stem cells, and were followed for 37 months. There was no evidence of any adverse proliferation or growth of the cells. There was no rejection. There was no serious safety issues. Most of the patients experienced an increase in their visual acuity.
Really outstanding news. And of course, since we're already injecting things into the eye, and of course, I'm referring to treatments for macular degeneration that require intraocular injection, seems like if you only have to do this once or a couple of times, that might be a really fabulous outcome.
It's really the first evidence of medium to long-term safety and graft survival and possible biological activity of these pluripotent stem cells.
Excellent news. We're going to be watching with that one. We know lots of people will get on board and want to do the phase 3 trials. Finally, then, let's turn to something that's a little disappointing. In the JAMA Pediatrics issue, exercise doesn't really seem to help protect against depression in adolescents.
And Elizabeth, like yourself, I was a little bit surprised about this, and I was hoping the results would be different, and that's because the onset of depression in adults is actually thought to occur during their adolescence or early life, and it'd be nice to have some preventive measures. Here's what the investigators did. They sought to investigate the association between physical activity and depressive symptoms during 3 years of adolescence, 736 adolescents, and they actually estimated their physical activity energy expenditure and how much time they spent in moderate and vigorous vigorous physical activity. They put particular devices that could detect the heart rate and the movement of these kids. What they determined is that depressive symptoms at 3 years follow-up was not significantly predicted by any of the measures of physical activity. There was no association between objectively measured physical activity and the development or prevention of depressive symptoms.
And of course, terribly disappointing. It would have been so great to see some kind of an association there. What about in comparison to the benefits of exercise with regard to depression in adults?
Well, there's good data that actually does help prevent depression in adults. That's why this is a little bit surprising and a little bit disappointing. But that doesn't mean that adolescents shouldn't be exercising.
There's lots of other good reasons to turn them out and make them run around like crazy because they have way too much energy, at least as far as I can tell.
If you don't turn the kids outside of the house, you're likely to be more depressed.
Indeed. I'm going to let you off the hook here because you're a poor voice and you got a lot of things to do yet today. So on that note, I'm going to reveal that I'm going to do the fecal transplant on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.